The reading's taken from Revelation chapter 6, which is on page 1237 in the Church Bibles. Revelation chapter 6, starting at verse 1. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and three quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer, until the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed as they had been was completed. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?"
Jenny, thank you very much. And it would be an enormous help to me if you could keep the Bible open on page 1237, Revelation chapter 6, and then we can follow together as we go through. It had been a magnificent week-long Christian conference. Cold, exceedingly uncomfortable, but stirring and strengthening. There must have been 2,000 of us packed into the big tent that final night. The speaker had finished, and the worship band had struck up. We sang. "There's going to be a great awakening," we sang. "Lord, we hear your spirit coming close, a mighty wave to break on the land." We sang, "The Lord is a warrior. We will march out with him. The Lord is a warrior leading us to win." And we sang, "Rejoice. Now is the time to march upon the land. Into our hands he will give the ground we claim." And as I went to bed, I knew that this time I was ready for action. Life would be victorious from now on. As I opened my front door the next day, there was a faint smell of damp. On closer investigation, it turned out that the pipes had burst in my absence. I was clearing up until last thing on Sunday night. Nonetheless, I went to work on Monday morning determined that this time there would be victorious Christian witness. They asked me about the week, but the second I mentioned the word Jesus, the ribbing began. Bible basher. God squad. Bill the Bishop's back. That's what they used to call me. And they spent the rest of the day trying to get me to swear. "Go on, say it." Not it. It was a different word. Now, by that evening, I was asking myself this question. You know, had I received an unrealistic impression of what the Christian life should be like that evening? Or alternatively, had I received the right impression, and was my Christian life somehow drastically subnormal? Well, if only I'd read Revelation 6. See, the Christian world has always been full of both optimists and pessimists. And there's no doubt that the Christian world today is particularly full of optimists in our climate. Optimists tend toward triumphalism. They suggest that the kingdom of God can be completely established here and now in this era before Jesus returns. But Revelation chapters 6 through 17 form a major corrective for us. They form a series of three, possibly four, cycles. And each cycle depicts for us one aspect of what life is going to be like for Christians in every generation between the period when Jesus was ascended, crucified, risen and ascended, through to his second coming. It's as if we had an OHP here, an overhead projector, and four transparencies, each one depicting a particular aspect of life in that period between Jesus' ascension and his return again. Each one had a particular aspect of that life, and they were laid on, and John is shown, well, life is going to be like that, one cycle, chapter 6. And then another one's taken, life will be like that, another cycle, chapter 8. And then life will be like this, and we see another aspect of life in that time period, chapter 12 to 13. And then chapter 15, another cycle, and another aspect of life. Do you see what John is doing? He's separating out for us, if you like, the interwoven strands, taking them one at a time and saying life is going to be like this in the world in this period between Jesus' ascension and his coming again. What we must not do is take those four cycles and lay them side by side along the timeline of history. I think I did five there. I mean four. All right, if there was a timeline here, we can't take the first cycle and say, well, that actually was the first century. And then the next cycle, well, that could be sometime between the third century and the fifth century, and so on. If we do that, we'll have the calculator out and we'll be trying to work out where Saddam Hussein fits in and who the UN are and so on. And we can't do that because every cycle we come to finishes with the final judgment of God. And then the next cycle goes back to the beginning again. So it is a cycle depicting that entire timeline. And you'll see that as we go through this particular cycle in chapter 6. Are you with me? I hope that's clear. And so these cycles enable us to be realistic as we live the Christian life between the period of Jesus' ascension and his coming again. And first, tonight, in chapter 6, verses 1 to 8, we learn that we must be realistic about the world in which we live. The four apocalyptic horsemen are symbolic, picture language figures representing four aspects of the world in which we live between Jesus' ascension and his return. War, anarchy, economic inequality, and death. Verses 1 to 2. The white horse. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals, then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. See, the white horse, the rider with a bow, the crown of power, the conqueror bent on conquest, all show a picture of military-minded rulers. Rulers intent on invasion and power-building and tyrannical rule. Now, according to the US think tank on the 3rd of January of this year, there were 71 such conflicts going on in our world, double the number as 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, ranging from Afghanistan right the way through to the Yemen Republic. So we must be realistic about the world in which we live. There will be war in every generation between Jesus' ascension and his return. Then verses 3 and 4, anarchy and insurrection. The second seal is open, verse 4, another horse comes out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other, and to him was given a large sword. Now, this horse is fiery red. It's an appropriate colour because his rider is going to bring bloodshed to innocent men and women and children. It's most likely that it represents anarchy and insurrection. The boffins who write the commentaries tell us that the word for slay is not a word that's usually used in battle, but for civil and terrorist-type activity. And the sword is not actually a large sword, but more of a sort of short dagger-type thing that you might get out if you were going to knife somebody on the quiet. So terrorism and insurrection are the key here. And again, our world is full of it. Bangladesh, Djibouti, France, Libya, Mali, Niger, Palestine, Ulster, the Docklands. We must be realistic about the world in which we live. One key aspect will be war and anarchy and terrorism. Economic inequality, verses 5 and 6. See, the third seal is opened, and out comes a rider, a black horse. A rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." Now, a lot of people have suggested that that is a picture of famine, but actually, as we look at it closely, it's less than famine, because the olive groves haven't yet been ploughed up. And a quart of wheat was enough for a day's food. And what he's saying is that a day's pay, which was the day's pay mentioned there, just about buys you enough for one day's food. No room for any extra luxuries. It's as if you're on the bread line, as if we were to walk into McDonald's and after the meeting tonight ask for the standard Big Mac, large fries and chocolate milkshake, and you'd be given, rung up on the till, 30 quid. See, we don't have to look very far to find that today. Economic inequality. We must be realistic about the world in which we live. And then verses 7 and 8, death. Now look at the colour of the horse. Its rider was named, it was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind. They were given a power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. The colour is a chlorine colour, a greeny, yellowy colour. Anyone who's seen a body that's been out in the sun for a day or two will know how evocative that is. You see what John is saying, or John is being shown, every age between Jesus' ascension and return will see the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They don't just appear as four shadowy figures at the close of the millennium or a couple of decades before the end of the world. They were all too apparent to John's readers in the seven churches. And they've been perfectly apparent in the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages and the Industrial Ages, the Technological Age, and now today, as we pick up our papers, in the Information Age. And as we look at the passage more closely, we will see why they appear. You see, the horsemen aren't just random operators at large and out of God's control beyond his rule. Look at verse 1. Jesus, the victorious, slaughtered lamb upon the throne, opens the seal. This is his first action in the final phase of God's plan for the universe. And look at verse 3. You see again there, the lamb opens. And verse 5, the lamb opens. And verse 7, the lamb opens. And then look at verse 1 again. You see, each of the horses are summoned out by one of God's messengers. It's a loud come out, a command. And it's there in verse 3 and verse 5 and verse 7. And then look again at verse 2. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown. And verse 4, its rider was given power. And then verse 8, its rider was given power. Do you see the point that John is being taught? However suave and civilized and sophisticated and developed the particular age we happen to be in, we must realize that we live in a world
that has rejected God's rightful rule, and as a consequence of our decision, in this final phase of God's plan for his universe, Jesus Christ ushers in this judgment. He opens the seals. And so God's judgment on our world begins. In the language of Paul in Romans, he gives us over to the consequences of human sinfulness. And as you get through to the next cycle in chapter 8, the language of judgment is even more powerful. And so the point for John's readers and for us today is this: don't let's be over-optimistic about the world in which we live. This is a pretty gloomy chapter. We'll never be able to build heaven on earth in a world that is under the judgment of God, where judgment has begun. And if you notice that these states are getting ready for another election, they seem to come around even faster than ours. And the religious right are receiving an enormous amount of publicity over there. Now, of course, it's right that they're working for high standards of morality and purity. But there's a danger, isn't there, with any movement like that, that its adherents get a sort of distant glitter in their eye. And they begin to think that, well, if only we gained political power, if only we got our guys into parliament, then we'll be able to put our world to rights now. We'll have a Christian state, and all will be well. Well, Revelation 6 warns us, don't be over-optimistic about any political party, ruler or philosophy. None of them will ever be able to build heaven on earth. The world in which we live is under God's judgment now. And you and I should never expect to do what so many of those over-optimistic choruses encourage us to think we can do. In this final phase of history, we shall never be able to walk tall and victorious through our world, untroubled by devastation and hardship. Now, this is only one aspect of life today, but this aspect will be there. Of course there will be joy, and so on and so forth, but we mustn't expect to have a life free from wars, rumours of wars, famine, earthquake, and all the things that Jesus warned us of in the Gospels. Now, I need hardly apply this, need I? I mean, some of us here live in the Docklands. Some were here when the bomb went off 2 years ago. Some have experienced unemployment, minimum wages, economic hardship. Some are students. Some have lost close family members through irreversible disease, sword, famine, plague, rail, motor disaster. I think of my keen Christian grandfather, a great servant of Christ, on the day he had to identify the remains of his 40-year-old eldest son and then head off to tell his widowed daughter-in-law and two grandchildren. You see, all of us will face similar experiences of one sort or another. We must not be over-optimistic about the world in which we live. Of course we're to work for the good of our neighbour. But however hard we work and whatever we achieve and however keen we are as Christians, we shall always find the apocalyptic horseman at work in one way or another. The amazing thing about these verses is that God actually restrains them in verse 8. They're only allowed a power over a quarter of the earth. And it's as if at the same time as judgment is being unleashed, it's also being withheld. So we must be realistic about the world in which we live. And that leads us to our second point. We must then be realistic about the Christian lives that we are to live in this world that is under judgment. We now, in verse 9, are shown the sixth seal being opened. And as Jesus opens it, we're shown a glimpse of the most faithful, dedicated, keen and honoured amongst all our Christian forebears. Look at verse 9. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. See what we're shown there? The mark of their life on earth was faithful witness to Jesus, involving suffering and eventual martyrdom. Now look at verse 10. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until that you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers, who were to be killed as they had been, was completed. See what we're shown there? The mark of their life in heaven now is patient longing. Faithful witness, future longing. And we have to ask ourselves, why are we shown that? What good would it have done to the seven churches that John is writing this letter to and every generation since then? And it seems that the point is this. Even in heaven, the most honoured and keen martyrs are still patiently longing for a future event. Yes, they've been given white robes to wear, indicating victory and the gift of purity and cleansing, but they are still waiting. Look at verse 10. You see, their cry is for God to bring justice to his world. Vengeance is a little bit strong. It's actually a legal word used in the law courts for justice. And as they cry, God replies, "Wait, be patient, hang on." You see the two key marks that dominate these people. Faithful witness in their life on earth, future longing. So if a key element of Christian living in every generation has been faithful, steady, committed concern for the gospel in the face of opposition, we shouldn't be surprised to find it now. And if a major feature of the life of the most honoured and faithful martyrs in heaven is patient longing for God to bring future justice, then that should be a major part of our concern too. We must not be unrealistic in the lives we live now as Christians. Being Christian is not easy. The road is narrow and steep. And each one of us, as we walk the road, will experience a kind of dissatisfied longing for a future day when God will bring justice. It's so easy, though, isn't it, to forget that and to long for a sort of Christian life that is easy and trouble-free and have a sort of sentimental longing. One of the ways we long like that is to long for the past. What about the thousands on Clapham Common who gather to listen to George Whitfield? Don't you sometimes long for days like that when the gospel days, Christian witness must have been easy, evangelism must have been a cinch? Don't you sometimes long for a day like Pentecost when one sermon and thousands were converted? Don't you long for days like that? It could almost be heaven on earth. But you see, as John shows us this glimpse behind the scenes into heaven, we find that actually those people then were martyred for doing what they did. The people who preached at Pentecost and those who followed him were nailed to crosses and dressed in wild animal skins and torn to shreds by dogs in the Roman amphitheatres. Whitfield rode for hours every day, burnt himself out at the age of 50, was pelted with bits of dead cat as he preached. See, the world has always hated Christians. Don't long for the past. It was no different then. And those martyrs up there are now, today, longing for a future day when God's justice will come and God in his judgment will intervene. Some of us don't long for the past. Some of us develop a sort of sentimental, optimistic longing to escape in the next few years. Janet and I find that when the going's tough in St. Helens here, or when I was in the army and being a Christian was rugged, you know, we'd secretly long for the day when we find a parish in the country with a rose-covered vicarage and gently cooing pigeons and expansive gardens and one parishioner who is stone deaf, so there's no point preaching to him. Actually, if we look at the world in which we live, we learn that the rose-covered vicarage, the roses would have green fly and the thatch would have wasps. But I don't know what your escapist dream is. You know, is it the rose-covered cottage? The move to the suburbs? The day you can graduate from RML leadership and put your feet up and take it easy in some nice quiet church somewhere? John's point is that Christian living has never been a doddle in a world that is in rebellion against its ruler. There's no early retirement or voluntary redundancy for the Christian. And even now the martyrs in heaven who've gone before us are not looking for an earthly solution when the church will rule on the earth and God will give us the ground we claim as we march on the land. They're not looking for a completely Christian England. They're longing, patiently waiting for a day when God will bring future judgment and justice. Now that is actually, though sounding a bit pessimistic, extraordinarily encouraging. Because if you find it tough to live as a Christian, if you face hardship at work and you're in the minority and they give you a hard time for one thing and another, or you're appalled at the injustice and you long for a day when God will sort it out, if you find the grind of living in London or having a quiet time or being single so grim that you long for a future day of judgment, then you are in the same boat as the honoured and most favoured martyrs who've gone before us. God says, wait. There are still more to come in. There are others to be rescued. Your Christian life is not subnormal. It is normal Christian living in a world that is under the judgment of God. And that brings us to our final point. We must be realistic about the dominant future event on the horizon of the universe, verses 12 to 17. Now this one night in November 1983, which will always remain emblazoned on my memory. It was about 2:30 in the morning. I was lying in a hole in the ground, which we'd just finished digging. It was a clear, clear, bitterly cold winter's night. And I was wondering what on earth had induced me to sign up for 5 years in the British infantry. I must have nodded off because the next thing that happened was a major explosion, followed by another and another and another. And there was then a momentary lull, and after which blood-curdling screaming began. Now, it was a training exercise, in case you're beginning to get a bit nervous. And on that exercise, our enemy were a company of Gurkhas who swarmed through the position. A friend of mine was in a trench about 50 metres away, and he'd just brought a brand spanking new sleeping bag. It had cost him about 200 quid, and he'd been bragging about it for days. It was all singing, all dancing, windproofed, rainproofed, warm as toast. And throughout the attack, all we could hear coming from his trench were loud expletives. The zip had stuck. And Tom was zipped up to his nose, only his eyes showing and unable to move. Now, eventually, one of the large and very wide training sergeant majors went over to his trench, jumped in, drew out a large army knife and split it open from top to bottom. And expensive lessons, feathers everywhere. But the reason I mentioned that night was that as I was awoken by those vast explosions, I was beside myself with abject terror. And I'd never experienced anything like this. I hadn't got a clue what was going on. Where do you hide? How do you escape? I thought I was dreaming at first. And then it was real. And it was only simulated shellfire. People who've been through earthquakes say that it is the most awesome experience, as everything that you've ever trusted as being secure and sound suddenly turns to jelly underneath you and begins to shake. See, as John opens this sixth seal, it is as if he presses the fast forward button and gives us a picture of one final and future event that lies ahead for our universe. And the dominant emotion surrounding this sixth seal is abject terror. Look at verses 12 to 14. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Now, of course, the vision is symbolic. John is using impressionistic language. But we need to stand back from it and say to ourselves, what is the impact, the intended impact? There's the snapshot of thick blackness as the sun is blotted out. There is the blood-red moon. And then in the semi-dark red light gloom, the stars just begin to fall out of the sky like apples do in the autumn. And then the whole sky races past John's eyes at the end of verse 14, like a manuscript does when you let go of it and it rolls up. And as we stand back, it is clear to us that John is telling us that this universe in which we live, as we know it, is a universe that is under judgment and it will come to an end. Now look at verse 15. Because on that day, the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, slaves, and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountain. And his point is that nobody will be able to escape this day from the most powerful, wealthy, and well-connected to the most famous and photographed and envied, through to the most lowly and inconsequential and insignificant. All will be levelled. We may have spent our life building palaces and storing pensions, pursuing salaries and share options, chasing status and security, pursuing pleasure and pride. But that won't stop the world being dissolved on that day. And on that day, in verse 16, we will find the homeless scrabbling for a place in a cave with the royal family. Criminals sheltering with the Home Secretary. Look at verse 16. Together the kings, the free men, the slaves, called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? See his point? However divided and distant we are in our politics and position today, we will be utterly united on this final day when God comes to judge his universe. And together we will all call, fall on us, hide us, from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the ruler against whom we have rebelled. See what John is saying? We must be realistic about the future event that hangs over the whole of our universe. Now, up to now, as we've looked at Revelation chapter 6, I've deliberately made an application to Christian people. That is right. I mean, this is a letter to Christian people. But it's only right as we close to speak clearly and plainly tonight to anybody who would not yet call themselves Christian. Because this is John's vision given to him by God of what will take place between Jesus' ascension and his coming again. And I need to ask, are you realistic about our world? War, anarchy, economic hardship, death? They will always be prevalent in a world that has rebelled against its rightful ruler. We live in a world under God's judgment. Of course it's right that we strive for improvement, but a very brief glance at the history books will show us that the words of Revelation 6 are absolutely true. Every generation, however wonderful their intentions, have faced war, anarchy, economic hardship, and death. We cannot build heaven on earth through politics or philosophies in a world that is in rebellion against its ruler. Be realistic about our world. Be realistic about your own future plans. You know, however magnificent the holiday home you or I build on the sun-drenched shores of the Bahamas or Brighton, we will never escape a future longing. We can never get to heaven on earth by our own escapist dreams. However big the pension you build up, you'll never build it because our world is under judgment. Be realistic about the future event that hangs over our universe. God will judge. The world is not just going round and round and round in pointless, meaningless circles. You and me and everybody in this room is going to be judged by God. And on the day when God wraps up the world and begins again, it won't matter how important or honored or rich or poor or powerful you have become. See, all our achievements will melt down into one burning question, and it's there in verse 17. The day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? And the answer to that question comes next week in chapter 7. So let's pray as we sit.